Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest today is Dennis Herbert, a director of a documentary that most fans may have heard of by now and hopefully have on their list of things to see. The movie is To Hell and Back, the Kane Hodder story. It's a fascinating dive into an iconic persona, an actor in our horror fandom. Everyone knows Kane Hodder played Jason in some of the Friday the 13th movies, and he's considered, arguably, to be the best Jason impressionist performer that we have seen. And we get to learn in this film a lot about Kane Hodder, the man, where he came from, how he got into stunts, the accident that changed his life, and how he is helping to change other people's lives. So welcome, Dennis.
Thanks for having me.
And this story is fascinating to me because I didn't learn about Kane's burn accident until I started covering a charity out of Williamsburg, Virginia. Actually, it's in Maryland, but they host a charity event in Williamsburg, Virginia called Scares That Cares. And they raise money for three families in need. And one of those families is always a burn victim. And I had heard that Kane had been a big part of getting the event off the ground. And I was like, he was burned, but he did a fire stunt as Jason White. And then I found out about the biography, the book, and then this movie came along the beginning of this year, and I was just fascinated. So how did you get involved in putting this project together?
So, yeah, I was looking for a good human interest story to tell, and I'm a huge horror fan, so I was hoping to tell a story within that realm as well. And so I was looking around for good stories, because that's really where these things begin. It's good stories and good subjects. And luckily, Kane's is both. But I saw some videos of him at, like, Dark Delicacies, a store here in Burbank, California. I saw other various kind of clips of him on the internet talking about his story and was fascinated by the little bits he revealed. And saw that he had written a book with Mike Aloisi called Unmasked. And I was, you know, I immediately picked it up and read it and then read it again before I gave this to my, you know, one of my best friends and entertainment attorney, Andrew Barcello, and said, you got to read this. I said, I really want to make this into a documentary. I want this to be my first feature. And, you know, I'm going to need your help in reaching out to his team. And so he read it, and he was also very impressed with the story. Like, from a human interest standpoint alone, this film is has a lot of elements that someone who, you know, it's really a somebody who went from pretty modest start in life to achieving a great deal, and the things he's gone through, the bullying, the burn, just kind of add to the incredible fact that he is at the top of his field. So somebody who, even if they don't enjoy horror, if they see the film as just a triumph of the human will and spirit, it still was a great story, and I knew it could be told well. And I wanted to be the one to tell it. You know, I'm a cancer survivor myself, so I really identified a lot with the survival aspects of it and wanted to really be the one to bring it to life. So we reached out to, well, actually Andrew started by reaching out to Kane's management, and eventually we sat down with Kane, and both Kane and us knew at that first meeting that we wanted to make this happen. So we got a contract together, signed everything right then and there, or like right very shortly after. And within like 2 weeks of our first meeting, we were on set shooting the first couple of days.
So how much extra research did you have to go before you started shooting? Because I noticed there were a lot of on-location sites, and historical photographs from when he was a teenager or a youngster. What was all that being pulled together at the same time you started shooting?
Yeah, a lot of it was. The photographs, for instance, were really compiled together later on during post-production when we had the pieces together and we knew elements we may need. We then started reaching out to Kane, to Mike Aloisi, who wrote his book with him, and started seeing, all right, where can we get these assets? We reached out to the photographer who took the original pictures. We reached out to of the burn incident. We reached out to a lot of different people to try to get the assets that we needed for the movie. And we ended up shooting a lot of our own B-roll stuff. We were lucky enough, I guess lucky is not really the term, but coincidentally, a fire had happened in the Valencia Santa Clarita area. And around the time we were shooting a lot of the, or wanting to shoot a lot of the extra stuff, the B-roll to do cutaways and everything. So we were lucky enough in a sense to be able to have an area that had been through a fire recently, but was starting to show life again. And I think that helped add as well to the story we were telling, the true story of Kane, because even through the points of being burned, there was still this like kind of life finds a way almost. And I think that helped as well. But it was a lot of compiling together things while we were going. Andrew reached out to the Both and Burn Center up in San Francisco, and we were able to get in there on the, you know, this was perfect timing as far as the fact that this happened this year, but they just built a new burn center, the new Both and Burn Center. So we got unrestricted access for 2 days to the old burn center, the one that Kane was in. The day after we left, it was going to be turned into part of the urgent care facility there. So we really had I think there were 3 days that it was unoccupied with anything. And we were in there, two of them. So it just worked out perfectly.
Yeah, that whole segment where he's talking about how he finally started to have hope about recovering from his injury by being in San Francisco after 4 months of hell at a hospital that literally did not know what they were doing, but they kept doing it anyway. That blows my mind. That completely blew my mind. But the fact that he was able to come back around and talk to the same doctor that saved him was so touching. And just seeing the emotion on his face when he's talking to this doctor again was just so, I mean, the fact that all that came together so perfectly for you, that's like serendipity coming down in a bowl from an angel.
Really, it really was. And the doctor was really at the Both and Burn Center. The crazy thing is that hospital must treat its employees right, because this nurse who's featured in the movie Paula has been there since the year after Kane was there. So while she wasn't there when Kane was, it just was the 40th anniversary of when Kane was burned. So she's been a nurse at this at a hospital for 39 years.
Yeah.
That to the fact that she was there at that point, and she works with the doctor to go out and do, because that doctor is still, while he doesn't practice here in the U.S., anymore, because he just doesn't. He still does a lot of things with charity, and he does a lot with like fixing cleft palates and like plastic surgery overseas still to help people. So she travels several times a year with him doing that kind of work. And the fact that when we talked about it, she's like, wait a minute, are you referring to Angela Capozzi? And we were like, yeah. She, said, yeah, he was the head surgeon at the Both and Burn Center during that time and for many years. So I'm sure that he was the one. So we reached out to Kane. Kane was like, yep, that was the doctor. And I don't believe he remembered the name, the full name, but he immediately knew that was the person when he heard it. And it was incredible. We were able to bring the doctor and him together again. And also, I think there was a big amount of closure for Kane by going to the hospital one more time, especially when it's been empty. There's nobody there. Seeing the new state-of-the-art burn center definitely brought a lot of hope to Kane for the future, because while the old one was very state-of-the-art for the time, it was certainly a little less state-of-the-art now. Still, the new place, it's just, you know, Kane wants to, you know, I'm sure Kane has been back to visit with survivors since, or definitely will go back, where he may not have gone back to the place he was in, again, if it wasn't for us. I don't know. It's just something about the place where you were in for a period of time, regardless of if they saved you, there had to be some hesitation there going back, for sure.
I can imagine that, you know, wanting to revisit something for closure, but not wanting to feel those feelings again. That's something I think all of us can understand in some way or another. And just seeing that he had a little bit of positive emotion on his face after seeing the doctor again, that was a little tear inducing. But most of the movie deals with his healing from, you know, being bullied, from being burned, and also being left behind by the Friday the 13th franchise, but still being beloved by fans and finding a new niche as a different kind of actor. That journey was as fascinating as anything, because I hadn't realized how the whole Freddy versus Jason thing first happened. I just remember hearing when the movie was coming out that, you know, Kane Hodder wasn't Jason. I'm like, whose idea was that? And just not paying attention anymore. So how did the story, you know, from you like filming for the documentary, how did that progress?
Well, I knew the basic story before, because he does talk about it in the book, but I was really anxious to try to get, I wanted to see in his eyes, because he says to him it was in some ways just as bad as being burned, not being able to continue, because it was, you know, a huge role of his career, but also like something he put his heart and soul into for four different films. And to be given a script saying we're going to do this and then not given it, yeah, that's a pretty low blow. And I'm pretty sure New Line knows that what they did was wrong in that aspect. Well, I hope so anyway. I'm pretty sure the executive who made that call is long gone from New Line and most of Hollywood, because I have my suspicions on who it is. But anyway, I don't know. It's just it was a bad call. I mean, mm-hmm. to give somebody, listen, I understand from perspective, it might make sense in theory. Okay, a stuntman in a mask can, any stuntman in a mask can play the role. In theory, given that Kane originally was a stuntman who was given the role, okay, I could see you putting two and two together. You could probably put somebody else in the role. But there should be an element of loyalty as well there, because he's been for a long time, as well as, like, I remember them doing a screen test for, I believe it was Nightmare on Elm Street 2. They even shot some of the movie with a stuntman in a mask that wasn't Robert Englund, because they didn't want to give Robert Englund, I think it was a raise, but also like any kind of respect for playing the role. They just kind of wanted him to do it again. And he wanted, you know, a little more, given that first one was very low budget and he wanted to be brought back with a little more. So they originally did a stuntman, realized that was a mistake and brought him back.
Yeah.
So I feel like, and I'm not saying Ken Kurtzinger, who played it in Freddy vs. Jason, did it in a bad way. I just feel like for a franchise film that has such an impactful history behind it, like Freddy vs. Jason was strangely a very long, long history of that film. Like they wanted to make that film before Jason X. Like, they were supposed to make it right after Jason Goes to Hell. It was going to pretty much start, the next film was going to be Freddy versus Jason.
Right.
But because of a lot of issues with the rights and the script and everything, it took longer to bring it to fruition. So Kane was all excited about playing it from way back then played Jason again, then was given the script, and then denied. So from a storytelling perspective, I just wanted to make sure that the audience knew how much this meant to Kane, and how much of a blow to his life it was. It wasn't just a career blow, because in the long run, I don't think it did that much, if anything, other than make his career even more varied. Because the fact that he was at the point where he wanted to take the Hatchet series, now he has 4 films in the Hatchet series. The fact that he was to that place where he wanted to play more roles other than that, now he has a lot of movies that have come out in the last few years. Death House, he has one coming out soon, An Accidental Zombie Named Ted, all these kind of things that he may not have pursued had he continued to play Jason in other films. So in some ways, I think it helped his career, but it certainly wasn't the way he viewed it at the time.
Yeah, from the way he was describing it, even though he has moved on and into a varied acting career that's still going on, that one moment in time stings. And, you know, even though you've moved on, that sting is still in there. You can see it in his eyes that he wishes that that could have happened, but good things have happened since then that sort of, you know,
yeah, mitigate and that's why I think, yeah. Yeah, I think that's why he was so passionate about receiving the honor of playing it in the video game, because to be told by the creator and everybody, all these like super fans who are making the game, that you should play not only the ones you did, but all of the Jasons, because they couldn't imagine having a Friday the 13th game without you as a character, is a huge honor to him. And that's why I think he jumped at it as much as he did and was, and really threw himself into it. He got hurt on set a little bit. I remember him posting a photograph of like a big bruise, nothing bad, but like he was willing to get that hardcore with the motion capture and with the elements so the fans would really have a good experience. And I know he would play the character again. And I really hope he does get this chance. I hope when everything settles down with his lawsuit and they make another movie, that Kane gets to play the role one more time. It's the 13th movie. They gotta give it to Kane. And I'm fighting very hard on his behalf on that as well.
Well, that's good to hear, because I know the I think the scenes where they show him in the motion capture suit, that those are like in the extras or the behind the scenes, yep, or something. They're hilarious because you see him picking up the people and the people are going, "Oh my God, really?" And
yeah,
just that looked like he was having so much fun.
He was. I mean, I was on set for like 12-hour day of that, or 8 hours of the 12 hours, something like that. And he literally would just pick people up and throw them, jump, break through walls, like all this kind of incredible stuff, kill people with a boat propeller. Like, it was like, and on set, it was pretty basic, you know, boxy kind of fake looking stuff, because obviously all they need is the motions. But you'd hear him off screen the way he normally would, like revving himself up, like shouting and kicking things and everything. And then he'd come on and do something straight face completely, like he was wearing the whole getup doing a movie scene. And that's what they got when they picked Kane. You know, they got him in character whenever he was doing any of that stuff. Walking, running, any of that stuff he would do as he would play the character. And obviously his Jasons didn't run, but since he was playing the other Jasons, some of them had to. So he had to go back and watch footage of them and how they ran and then try to replicate it, because he wanted to be respectful of all the other Jasons and what they brought to their versions of the movies.
And that just embracing of Jason is something that reflects in how much the fans truly, truly love him. And the scenes where you are at, I think it was like two different conventions you went to with him,
Yeah, we
where.
went to the first convention was Days of the Dead in Indianapolis, and then we went to Walker Stalker in Atlanta.
Yeah, just seeing him interact with the fans and seeing the joy on some of their faces, even as they're being, choked out by Kane for a photo op, they're grinning. They're like, "I can't breathe. This is so awesome." It was just seeing that interaction and him seeing the love from the fans, the people that mean the most to him playing Jason, was a real treat.
His lines at these conventions never end, and he is so loved. And I mean, he loves his fans just as much. He truly believes that with, and it's a pretty obvious thing to say, but still, it's obvious to me, but there are a lot of celebrities who do not feel this way. That they would not, he wouldn't be where he is if it wasn't for the fans. A lot of people who make it don't view it that way. They view it as they're doing something special for the fans. The fans should be grateful. Whereas Kane believes that he should be grateful for the fans. That's why he rarely will get up at conventions. He feels so apologetic even when he has to use the bathroom or grab a bite to eat. Like he'll usually bring the food back to his table and eat it there or have somebody bring him food at the table. He'd rather not get up as much as possible. That's why he tries to limit how many photo ops he does, how many panels he does at each convention, so that he is at his table the most of the time. Because not only obviously there's a, people pay for his autograph, but it's not about that. It's about being there for the fans. Because I'm sure you go to conventions and there are certain people who are never there. There are people that I've literally gone to convention with Kane. And I've seen their table like a couple of times. The majority of the time, they're like walking around or I don't know where, but Kane is at his table the entire time, all 3 or 4 days of the convention, all the time. Unless, again, he has a panel or a photo op, but that's why he does try to limit those so that he doesn't have to walk away too often.
Does he enjoy doing the panels as much as he does just being there for the fans?
He really does. It's just about whether or not he wants to leave his booth to do them. But he loves, I mean, him and I had an amazing panel just a little while ago at Monster Palooza where we screened the first 10 minutes of the movie, and but this is before it came out, and released an updated version of the trailer with that's where we announced the release dates for the first time. And we streamed the entire panel on through the Masterfully Macabre Facebook page, and it was a huge venue, and there were like well over 1500 people, probably well over 2000 people in that venue crammed in there, all wanting to ask him questions, all wanting to hear about the film. And it was incredible to see that level of enthusiasm for it. I mean, it's been a long time coming. We did something that I don't usually like to do, where we announced the movie very early. Normally, you would announce a movie like coming out in 6 months or whatever. We announced it like a year and a half before it came out because we did the Indiegogo to raise enthusiasm for the movie and some money for the Bothan Burn Center and some basic finishing funds for like doing things like the visit to the Bothan Burn Center, things that were extra that we were able to get in at the last moment after the majority of our investors' funds were already, allocated to other aspects of the production, but we really wanted to do. So because of that, we also people wanted, the movie was our progress, even though movies take a long time, like people thought like, oh, it's gonna come out in 6 months. It was like, well, no. It's gonna be like at least a year before it comes out. But and then, things take time. We had to get in some great festivals like We premiered at Fright Fest in London about a year ago this time, because Fright Fest is going on right now, this year's, and then did a few festivals around the U.S. and then with our L.A. premiere being at Scream Fest in Los Angeles. But like then we had to sign with a distributor, then work with a distributor on a release date, then get everything together, then have everything made. So like July 13th was longer than I thought it would be, but ended up working out so perfectly because not only was it a Friday the 13th, but July 13th was 41 years to the day where Kane was burned.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought it wasn't
a Friday the 13th, but it was a July 13th, 1977. Yeah.
Wow. And I had thought that the Friday the 13th release date was a marketing gimmick saying, okay, if we release this on Friday the 13th, so we'll just push it back. I thought that was the reason it was pushed back for so late, because it was funny.
It was a marketing decision a little bit based on that, but it was also, we knew we could also push the human interest aspect as well by doing the 41 years to the day. And I thought it would be very compelling for a lot of people if it also did come out on a Friday the 13th. We also had to work with, like, Dread Central Presents already had films in their pipeline. So they didn't want to, the way they operate is they'll do one movie maximum a month so they can give it their whole attention. So we had like most of June and July of just us on their promotions, just us being, you know, pitched everywhere. So like it's definitely was nice. We had a pretty decent, you know, we had a bunch of theaters around the US that did a small theatrical run of the movie. I'm still open to other like film festival screenings. If people, you know, festivals wanted to screen it, I'd be thrilled to have it screened again, because I did shoot this movie to look great on an iPad, on a computer, on a TV, but it also looks amazing in the way it was shot, which is 4K scope aspect ratio. So I'd love to see it on the big screen, because that's like the ultimate version of the movie, in my opinion. The 5.1 surround sound sounds better. Yeah. The image is the crispest it's ever going to be, because even on the disc, it has a, like, I worked very hard with them to make sure that the image of the movie was the highest priority. I said, like, I want the image of the movie to be, like, the best it can possibly be. The bonus features to be lower than that. At the way bottom of it are the trailers that we throw on the disc. I don't want the trailers to be beautiful, gorgeous HD if the movie isn't as well. Like, I want the movie to be the shining example. Bonus features can be a little less than that, and the movie or the trailers, yeah, the lowest. Just because I knew the fans and myself as a fan, you want to have, if you're going to go out and buy the disc, and I'd recommend people buy the disc for this movie because it's not that much more than the digital version and has 90 minutes of bonus footage. Like, that is all like continued scenes of the movie with a lot of extra stuff that we don't get a chance to dive into in the film. But it's just as fascinating as the rest.
One of our Slice of Sci-Fi contributors got to see a advanced screening of it at the Brooklyn Horror Film Festival back in, I think, February. And I think it was a late edition or something, because I had asked him, it's like, hey, you want to go to the Brooklyn Horror Film Festival? He says, let me know when they get something cool in there. And I said, like a couple days later, hey, they've added To Hell and Back, the Kane Hodder document. And as soon as I said Kane Hodder, he said, I'm in. And he was blown away by it back then. And I was thinking, okay, it's premiering on West Coast, East Coast. We should be seeing this movie in a month or two on VOD. And then it wasn't showing up, and it wasn't showing up. So I'm glad that the timing shifted so much, because like you said, now you still want it to appear in film festivals. All of the October Halloween horror film festivals are coming up in September and October, so that I hope a few of those approach you for screening it, because this, like you said, this is a gorgeous film. I mean, I watched it on a computer screen, and the sharpness, the detail you could see in the background of some of the scenes, even the shots that you included from some of the movies, is breathtaking. So yes, I hope more people get a chance to see this on the big screen before buying the Blu-ray or trying to see it on Netflix. Is it going to Netflix?
That I don't know. I know it is available on the VOD platforms, Vudu, Amazon, iTunes, PlayStation, Xbox, all that kind of stuff. I'm not sure about the streaming sites, like Amazon Prime, Hulu, Netflix, Shudder, any of those quite yet. I believe that's something they usually pitch later on once the film's been out for a little while. But we'll see what happens with it.
Yeah, because Netflix is where I actually saw the documentaries, the Friday the 13th documentary and the Nightmare on Elm Street documentaries. They were like 3 and 4 hours long each. So it would be a shame if Netflix didn't also pick this one up. So I'm just putting that out to the universe for you.
Thank you.
So when you were making this film, what was something that surprised you, something that you didn't expect?
Well, I don't think, no, if I expected it to be as crazy, how many people would, the fact of the matter is every single person that was important to get in the film that didn't have a major scheduling issue was able, like they all wanted to do it. And there are a bunch of people that, and why I say that is there, it's certainly a couple of people we wanted in the film and they wanted to be in it. But for whatever reason, the universe didn't allow it to happen. Every time we had something set up, it was, they ended up booking another gig or doing something like that. So it was, which is great for them, but it just meant that they unfortunately couldn't be in this film. You know, there's no hard feelings, obviously, on either side. It's just the nature of the beast. But the fact that everyone was so gung-ho, I mean, Cassandra Peterson drove 3 hours through traffic to get to us to do her interview before she drove to the airport to fly to visit her mom for a while. Like she went from doing a panel announcing her show at Knott's Scary Farm 2 years ago to our interview to the airport.
Wow.
And had no problems with it because that's how much she cared about Kate. And there were a lot of stories that Robert Englund spent a lot more time than I think his manager wanted him to away from his table at the convention. Doing his interview, you know, I think he was supposed to be away for 30 minutes. He spent an hour with us. You know, there was a lot of things. Adam Green had a very big business meeting, yet continued talking well into when he should have left. And then allowed us to stick around with one of his team members there to be able to get a lot of shots of the Victor Crowley and the Meshuggah figurines, like, and all of like his shelves of props and memorabilia and all that stuff in case we wanted to use it as inserts. And I know we did use a few of them. So we were very happy that he gave us that, you know, luxury of allowing us to stay. He, you know, didn't know us before that day, but he, you know, him and I are now certainly colleagues and hoping to work on this new project that we announced, but it's kind of in a holding pattern, another documentary. So
is documentary style storytelling something that you're passionate about? Is this something that you would want to continue doing again and again?
I certainly am passionate about documentaries, and I would continue to do them again. I do love narrative films as well, and that's where I think I really want to put the emphasis of my future on. But I feel like documentaries are something that for not a ton of money, you can make very well. And make something that you're proud of and you want to, and it's harder to do that for narrative work. However, not impossible. It's just harder. I produced a film that is coming out pretty soon called They're Inside, which is a story of two sisters who go with a group of friends into this like house in the middle of nowhere to film a movie and then things don't go as planned. It's like a horror thriller film, and that was shot for very low budget, but is an incredible movie and just finished post-production. And I couldn't be more proud of that film and really hope that it gets out there and gets in a bunch of festivals and gets out and does a big release, because I feel like this is one that could easily go theatrical and really be something that helps the amazing director's career take off, the writer, and Andrew and I, the same producers of The Doc and Master of the Macabre, be able to make something else bigger, especially and other projects with the same team.
Can you talk about your new project that you're working on with Adam Greenberg?
Yeah. Like I said, it's early stages. We announced it, but I really don't know fully what it's sort of a holding. We're doing a documentary on the show he did, Holliston. The story, though, is pretty much like the Rocky of horror documentaries in a lot of ways, because that's the show that he wanted to do. It's the reason he's in L.A. at all. Is he did he started out his career with the movie Coffee and Donuts, which is the early stage of Holliston. Like, it's pretty much the same story. It's his story. It's pretty much the same as Holliston. And Holliston was on so many different networks and so many different things. And before it was ultimately made at FearNet. And then a million things happened at the same time that FearNet closed. That brought, you know, it became a very low point in his life that he's talked about before, but not into the detail that we're going to go into. And really, we're waiting on the next season to be picked up, because both Adam and us want this to be a very positive story. And we both know that it will get picked up, because I don't know if you've watched Holliston, but it's really good. And the fact that you can make a sitcom that's hilarious, but with horror people and with a lot of references like that, is incredible that it had the success it did. And because it had that success, I know that they're going to be able to find another home. And that's when we'll make the documentary. When, and I'll have more to say about it, is when it gets picked up for another season, then we're going to really get gung-ho about making that film.
Cool. Well, I for one have been disillusioned with the sitcom for about 40 years. So anything that turns the sitcom on its head while bringing a different style of humor is always worth the experiment to me.
Agreed. Yeah, that's, I think, what made The Office work and a lot of those shows, is doing something different. The traditional sitcom isn't always as effective. There are examples that in modern times that are pretty good, but there's also examples that are awful. And, you know, you have to play it easy. I'm not usually a reality show guy either, but there are some examples. And Practical Jokers is really funny, for instance. And yeah, there's a few other things that, I would love to work in that realm, just because I feel like it's similar to documentaries, but it's also a different medium. And I kind of just want, you know, I love telling good stories. So whether it's, and being part of telling them, so whether it's a great narrative or a great documentary, as long as I get a chance to tell great stories, I'll be happy.
I hope that Holliston gets picked up soon so you guys can continue on your other projects. Is there anything else you're working on you'd like to tell our listeners about?
On my label, Dread Central Presents, that to Hell and Back is on Director's Cut, which was
Pendula, yes.
The movie that Adam Rifkin made with him, is also on that label. And so my boyfriend and I actually went to the, you know, I try to go to as many events as I can that they throw, because, you know, as a member of the Dread Central Presents family, I love to support the other filmmakers as they do. You know, they all came to Hell and Back LA launch as well. That we did, which was a wonderful night. And I couldn't be happier with the amount of, you know, people that came. I mean, Felisa Rose, Carolyn Williams, so many different, Bill Moseley, so many different horror people came out. And a lot of people I didn't even know that weren't even in the film wanted to come just to support the movie, like Amanda Weiss from Nightmare on Elm Street, and so many people like that just really wanted to be there to support Kane and the film, even though they weren't in the film. They still wanted to see the story of a person they respect so highly. Other than They're Inside, which I, again, cannot recommend it enough when it comes out. It's certainly a really good film that turns its head on a lot of the traditional horror aspects, and it's really quite of an involved story, but something that I think everyone needs to see. And then the Holliston documentary that is still in holding. I mean, there are a few things I'm working on, a short film, potential reality pilot, but nothing that I can, that's really solidified enough for me to announce. But I always like to keep busy. I mean, this is my passion. This is what I do. And I can't think of a reality in which Talonback is the only film that I make.
Well, that's heartening to hear, because you did a wonderful, wonderful job. I'm a fan of documentaries, and this one was beautifully told and gorgeously shot. So kudos on that.
Thank you. I'll let my cinematographer know as well, because he did some incredible work with half the time, very little to work with. On a lot of the location stuff, it was harder to bring in our normal gear. So we had sometimes had like, you know, three lights and cheap little stands with like just one camera. And like, I remember shooting Twisted. We were in upstairs of the Palladium Theater in Worcester, Massachusetts. And it's an old theater, a very nice theater, but like an older theater that's been remodeled to be able to do rock shows and modern shows. So it's not quite soundproof up in the areas up there. So we were put, there was like a couch and a couple and lamps and stuff. And we were put in there and we lit it and set up the camera and everything and got everything good to go. And all the while there's bands playing. So the whole time I'm just 100% convinced we're never going to be able to use any of this audio, because literally there was like a rock show going on downstairs, rock or rap, because Twisted was, it was one of their events that they put on. Mm-hmm. So they were the closing like headliner of it. And so we interviewed them before, and I was like, we're never going to be able to use any of this audio. And then the sound mixer played it back for me, and I was shocked that it was fairly clean. And then our audio mixer, who was phenomenal in post, went in and cleaned up all of that kind of stuff too, and removed random echoes and various other sequences. Like when you're dealing with people and you're dealing with a lot of different sources of materials, given that we shot in a lot of different places, like, you know, a gigantic room in Atlanta. They gave us an entire like ballroom of the convention center. It was like a huge convention center room. Like we were the only thing on like the second floor of the convention center. And they gave us this massive room, and it was like, okay, well, we have, I guess we'll be fine here. So we set up in the like tiniest little corner of it that we could, because we didn't have a ton of lights, because we only rented the same things we had rented for Indianapolis. And they gave us a nice big room, but it was like a fairly large office room that we then, like little conference rooms, which we then, you know, grabbed some set dressings from these amazing local vendors who did a haunted house. And they let us borrow like a bunch of their netting and like stuff in it, and like a corpse dummy that we had in the background. So that, and we lit it and everything looked great. And then we get to Atlanta, get this huge space, but we came up with a pretty cool way to light it with the lights we did have. I think it worked very well, but it was a lot of different experiences by doing that kind of stuff. Like, and being able to turn all these random things, light them well, and give me depth of field and everything with the limited amount of stuff we had and space was incredible.
That wouldn't happen to be the interviews where there's pink lighting and the shadows of mic stands to the left of Bruce Campbell, are they?
Yeah, I mean that's part of it too. Those are actually the Atlantis stuff was actually like Robert Englund, Zach Galligan, Felissa Rose, and like Sid Haig, Bill Moseley. Those ones were done in Indianapolis. The pink lighting and like Cassandra Bruce, all that was done in a soundstage here in LA. It was just a different soundstage than the one we used for Kane's interview.
Because I was so distracted by the pink light. I'm like, the light is pink. Why is the light pink? But it was so gorgeously lit. I'm like, it's pink.
Yeah, we just wanted to do something different on the background because it was a white background. I didn't want a white background. So like a light pink, we wanted to do something that would separate from Bruce or Cassandra and make it more interesting than just white. Because I'm not a big fan of white. And in fact, the only shots in the movie I'm not as big of a fan of, and I'm the one who pushed for it, was the ones against black. I don't think I'll do that again in the future. Just because, I mean, while it looks good, in sense, it just, I much prefer interesting backgrounds. Like, we came up with some much more interesting things in the film than that. And that's what I like being able to do, like shooting people like Ted White, where we shot him in his own backyard. It was a gorgeous backyard. Shooting in like Atlanta, where we had like the cool rock wall behind us, or shooting in Indianapolis with like the creature. Like, it's better if there's something that isn't a solid color behind somebody. And that's why we did things with like shadows of stands, or I think Cassandra's, we have like a carrying case for some of the lighting gear in there because we wanted to make it more interesting than just a solid color.
Well,
So,
again, yeah, kudos to you and everyone else. And as far as shooting on black backgrounds, live and learn, I guess.
no, I mean, it looks, I mean, I'll be honest, it still looks great, so I'm not opposed to it by any means, but yeah, I definitely learned there are definitely more technique, and that's the one thing I am happy the DP gave us is because he knew that might happen. He blasted a beautiful light behind each of the subjects, so they are separated from it, and they have a nice light behind them. So at the very least, there's that. So it's definitely more than the More went right than could have if I had a DP that didn't know what they were doing. But luckily that wasn't the case. Zach Hunter is a friend of mine, but he's also an incredible camera op and DP, and I'm very proud to have had him on this film, and hopefully we'll have him on many of my films moving forward, if not all of them.
Cool. Now, where's the best place for people to find out what you're working on next, keep up with what you're doing?
Well, yeah, the greatest thing, the greatest places to find out about us are Facebook, Masterfully Macabre Entertainment LLC. We have a Facebook page at Masterfully Macabre on Instagram, at Masterfully M on Twitter. Those are the three best social medias. If you go to our website, kanehottermovie.com, it's a little outdated as far as the a sale announcement on there being like, I think it still says like Christmas or New Year's or something, but the items are, we have a lot of perks. We also have a newsletter that you can sign up for as well. But as far as like perks, I mean like merchandise, like the Kane Hodder Legends t-shirt where it has his face as well as Jason and Victor Crowley. We have like signed machetes, prop machetes. We have that are real metal. We have signed pocket knives that are come with a certificate of authenticity. They look exactly like the ones in the game, and that he signed them all, and they're hand numbered and come with a beautiful certificate. And
Nice.
so we have various things like that, but there's also a newsletter on there you can sign up for that we will blast you when there's sales, when there's announcements like it's coming here, or a new version, or have you purchased the Blu-ray yet? Those kind of, though we try not to do too many announcements, but we try to do them when they're relevant. Like when the
That's
movie came out, we said.
cool. Well, the movie is To Hell and Back, the Kane Hodder story. It is available now on VOD. It is also available on DVD and Blu-ray. I would recommend the Blu-ray just because of the bonus content, the teaser where he's dressed in mocap and throwing people around is more than worth it, even though you can find that trailer online. I suggest getting it in Blu-ray and just watching it in its full digital glory. We will have links to the website Kane Hodder Movie, where you can sign up for all that stuff yourself and to where you can purchase the Blu-ray. Derek, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Slice of Sci-Fi.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you. Wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa. The first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award. With weekly stories from the world's best authors. Michael Moorcock. Peter Watts. Joe Haldeman. Peter F. Hamilton. And many, many, many more. With news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pohl, Wolf, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
This is Stephen Kilpatrick, host of Tales to Terrify, and you're listening to Slice of Sci-Fi.
I hope you had as much fun with that interview as I did. I had been waiting to talk to him for the longest time, ever since I had first seen the documentary a few months back, and then I watched it again last month, back in August, just to refamiliarize myself with it. And when people spend so much time telling the deep background of a story that they love, that always comes across in the final product. And if you have not yet seen To Hell and Back, this is a very, very, very good time to go see it for yourselves. It is not currently playing in theaters or any film festivals in the immediate future, but if it does show up in a few, I will definitely let people know. The movie itself, if you are a YouTube Movies subscriber, it is there. It is also on Amazon. It is also on iTunes. And of course, you can buy the Blu-ray. Like I said, I'd recommend it for the extra few hours of deleted scenes, but we have more documentaries coming up to talk about. We also have more indie horror to talk about coming up, actually, I think next week. So stay tuned for that. If you have any questions or comments, especially about the upcoming fall television season, which I am so excited for, The Gifted starts up September 25th, season 2 of The Gifted on Fox. Do not miss it. I think that's the one I'm looking forward to most of all. I'd have to go double check, see what's coming back. I don't know when Lucifer is coming back. I don't know when The Expanse is coming back. Those are probably all dropping in 2019, like Game of Thrones. So we have to wait another few months for those. But we'll talk TV later. But if you do have any comments or questions, the number to call is 602-635-6976. Or you can send me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play, on TuneIn, and on Krypton Radio. If you are listening on iTunes or Stitcher, please leave us a review over there. All reviews do help with our profile. Let other people find the show easier and let people know that other people are finding the show interesting and maybe they should check it out for themselves. You can follow us on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi over there. We're also on YouTube and Facebook. We're Slice of Sci-Fi on those locations too. And of course, we have the website, sliceofscifi.com, where you can listen to previous episodes of this show and also check out the movie reviews, TV reviews, and other fun stories to tell. If you are interested in writing for Slice of Sci-Fi, also send me an email. We can talk. I'd like to thank everyone for your donations, your patronage through Patreon, your pledges through Patreon, the website to go to add your pledges if you want to help support these efforts here is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. All proceeds from Patreon go to pay for keeping these shows, these websites online. So everyone who's currently a supporter, thank you very much. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, again, the URL to go to is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. I'd also like to send a hearty, healthy, happy, loving shout out to my favorite geek rock band, Sci-Fried, for providing the musical themes that you hear on the show. Thanks, guys. And if you like your rock and roll geek flavored, the place to find out more of what they're cooking up is sci-fried.com and also their YouTube channel, Sci-Fried. You can find it very easily. Just search for them on YouTube and prepare to be entertained. But that will do it for this episode. Thank you so, so much for listening. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.